Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Texas A&M Kingsville versus Lawson.
May it please the court, Ms. Meredith Branson will present argument from petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, for over 150 years, both the legislature and this court have agreed on at least one thing, that it is the legislature's prerogative to grant or deny waivers of sovereign immunity. In amending Chapter 2260, the legislature made clear that Chapter 107 remains the one route to the courthouse for breach of contract claims not covered by Chapter 2260.
But since our decisions in Aerotex and those cases, the legislature came back in and threw us back into the position we were in before 2260, didn't they? On some contracts, and my question is this one of those contracts?
No, Your Honor, the legislature, in amending 2260, simply made clear that certain contracts would not be covered by 2260, but it expressly asserted its authority to grant or deny waivers of sovereign immunity in Section 2260.007. The legislature expressly stated that they retain the authority to deny or grant waivers.
Let me just sort of rephrase my question. By carving out these contracts that were executed before a certain date, and I assume this is one of those.
This is a contract we admit is not covered by Chapter 2260.
Okay. By specifically carving that out after our decisions in those cases, don't they throw us back into the pre-2260 jurisprudence that had some waiver by conduct cases percolating through? In other words, aren't we now faced directly with that question?
No, Your Honor. The legislature made clear in its legislative history that it did not question the underlying premise of Little Tex, and it simply wanted to clarify that parties could always go to the legislature, regardless of 2260, they could always directly petition the legislature under Chapter 107.
But as I recall, the premise of Little Tex, it was that the legislature has, by enacting 2260, demonstrated its intent to control this field, and because of that intent, we are going to find no waiver by conduct exception. Then the legislature went back after we did that and said, no, not as to these contracts. And is that not a signal to us, some way by the legislature, that they wanted us in the laws that was established before 2260?
No, Your Honor. They did not question the court's finding in Little Tex that apart from the special statute granting consent to sue, a party simply may not sue the state absent consent, legislative consent under Chapter 107 or some other statute. And in this case, there is no clear and unambiguous legislative consent to sue. Respondent is attempting to file suit directly in court without bypassing the legislature.
Why did the legislature go back and amend after our decisions? Do you know?
Well, Your Honor, from the legislative history, it appears that the legislature wanted to make it easier for certain contracts to go directly to the legislature. For example, contracts over $250,000 that were subject to 2260 previously would have had to go through the administrative procedures, even though they would not have been able to get an appropriation. Contracts over $250,000 would have had to be referred back to the legislature, and it would have basically, the legislature was making it easier for certain contracts to directly go to the legislature to seek consent under Chapter 107. So in a sense, it did make it easier for contractors.
They didn't express that anywhere, did they?
Yes, Your Honor. Actually, the legislative history, and the state has cited it in I.T. Davy case in the briefing there.
No, I'm talking about the legislative history of the latest amendment, 2260.
Yes, Your Honor. In the requested supplemental briefing in the I.T. Davy case, we have legislative history excerpted that shows that the legislature wanted to make it easier for parties to go directly to the legislature rather than going through Chapter 2260 when those procedures could not grant relief to a party with a contract over $250,000.
All right, I don't remember. It's been a while since I've read those briefs, but I thought that the amendment dealt with contracts executed before a certain date, not as to certain amounts. And how does that square with the legislative intent as you just expressed it?
Well, the statute does exempt certain contracts the contracts that were entered into prior to August 30th of 1999.
And why?
Many of those contracts were, the older contracts that were in existence were over $250,000. That those were still around and would not have been able to get an appropriation directly through the administrative procedures. They would have had to go through the administrative procedures and then gone to the legislature to get a waiver still. So basically, it enabled parties. The legislature expressed that it always has retained the authority to grant or deny waivers of sovereign immunity. And some contracts are going to fall under 2260.
I may have said that, but we've said all along that sovereign immunity was a creation of the court, and the court could do away with it. So, I mean, it's nice for the legislature to say, well, this is ours, but they didn't get it from them.
Well, Justice Enoch, we respectfully disagree with that the idea of sovereign immunity is inherent in the principle of sovereignty to be immune from suits without the legislature's consent. And indeed, this court, in its first case, Herring versus Houston National Exchange Bank, considered this issue in the breach of contract case situation and found that it is inherent and it is generally recognized as an attribute of sovereignty to be immune from suit without the legislature's consent. But regardless, what we have here is the legislature has essentially occupied the field of waivers, immunity, and breach of contract cases.
If we didn't have the timing issue with the amendment to Section 2260, would 2260 even apply in any event, since it governs contracts for goods and services? I mean, it doesn't seem to me that it comes even within the purview of the statute, even if we didn't have the timing amendment.
We don't believe it falls within the statute. Okay. The Third Court of Appeals, in an unpublished opinion, stated they believed that settlement agreements could be treated as services contracts.
That's not the state's position.
We are not arguing that, and we don't disagree that Chapter 2260 does not apply in this case. But what does apply is that Chapter 107 requires a party to go to the legislature to get legislative consent to sue prior to filing suit. And either a contract falls under 2260 or it doesn't, and Chapter 107 applies. But together, those two provisions address all breach of contract claims against the state. Either they go through 2260.
You were not immune from the underlying claim. Not immune from the underlying claim, is that correct?
And that's where I want to go. The record is scanty here about what the causes of action were in the underlying claim, and whether the state filed a plea to the jurisdiction. What happened there?
It was a suit for wrongful termination, and that case was settled. That is a case that, you know, if immunity had been waived for the wrongful termination suit, that does not apply to this lawsuit.
Well, I understand the difference. I just want to understand what happened down below. So in the first case, is it the state's position that immunity was waived?
It was a suit for wrongful termination, and I believe that the state would have waived a sovereign immunity for that.
Okay. And then under that circumstance, why would anybody ever settle with the state then? If there was no immunity in the first instance, why all of a sudden now settle with the state if the state's going to force immunity against itself from the underlying settlement agreement?
Well, Your Honor, there's no evidence that the state is routinely breaching settlement agreements.
Well, if it just does it once every 100 years, why would you ever do it? Why would you trade a case where the state doesn't have immunity for a case in which they do?
Well, and this settlement agreement is an example of the primary benefit of settlement agreements is generally monetary, and there's no question that respondent was paid the $62,000.
Well, what if he weren't, he still couldn't sue you for the money. That's your position.
He could sue the state only after obtaining legislative consent under Chapter 107, and there is a remedy for
he could have gotten a judgment against the state for whatever damages he was entitled to after a trial. The state's not immune from that. But you could settle the case, sign the document, promise to pay him the money, and the next day tell him, sorry, you screwed up, we're not paying you the money.
Well, generally,
go see the legislature.
That has not been the case.
But you could do that.
That could happen, but yeah. There, the party who would be aggrieved in such a way would certainly have a remedy and could go to the legislature. And the legislature has indicated its willingness to take on these cases. And if indeed it becomes problematic that the state is breaching settlement agreements, the legislature, it is the legislature's role to come in and create a new remedy. And they could craft a new provision that would address settlement agreements.
Or they could say, I'd rather this money go toward highway construction and not craft a remedy.
They could not, but or they can address these claims directly under Chapter 107, and as parties have traditionally been required to. And for the court should continue to defer to the legislature now that it has expressed its intention to maintain its, and it has repeatedly expressed its intention to maintain the exclusive authority to grant or deny waivers of sovereign immunity. If the court were to craft some kind of judicially imposed exception to sovereign immunity from settlement agreements,
say that if you settle a case that you're not immune from liability in, you're not immune from liability on the settlement agreement. That seems like a fairly easy rule.
Well, Your Honor, that would conflict with the court's consistent precedent. It would conflict with the court's holding in Federal Sign that merely by executing a contract that the state cannot waive sovereign immunity. In Little Text, the court held by the state's conduct it cannot waive its sovereign immunity.
In fact, the court held that jurisdiction, that waiver of the right to be sued or the right to not be sued is a jurisdictional inquiry that can be raised at any time.
Yes, Your Honor.
So irrespective of whether or not you waive jurisdiction, if it's a waive sovereign immunity back to be sued originally, can be raised at any time, can't it? I mean, the court wouldn't have jurisdiction on that. So, you know, this gentleman's got to go to the legislature and get his redress.
And that is the proper body. The people's representatives in the legislature are best equipped to address policy questions such as are raised in this suit, because otherwise, if the court were to craft one, I think that would create a Pandora's box of litigation.
Why isn't it a policy decision? Why hasn't it already been made with the decision to settle the lawsuit, which the state contends it had the authority, I've gathered, to settle the lawsuit and agree to various terms, including the payment of money? Why aren't those decisions already made?
Because, Your Honor, there is no clear and unambiguous legislative consent to waive suit. All you have.
But did the governor's office and the comptroller's office ratify this decision?
Yes, Your Honor, but that is not a legislative decision. And what you have reaching a settlement agreement, only a handful of officials, state officials, can basically agree to bind the state to potentially far-reaching, ill-conceived, and expensive settlements. Without the input of the people's representatives.
If it's expensive, then the state's never going to be able to settle a case now. I mean, plaintiffs are going to be forced to try their cases to judgment. They have no choice because settlements are not enforceable.
Your Honor, this is nothing new. Nothing has changed. For the court to uphold its consistent precedent would not...
No, but my question is, isn't it going to hurt the state's ability to settle? Plaintiffs are no longer going to be willing to settle their cases with the state.
No, Your Honor, we don't believe so because parties do have a remedy in going to the legislature. The legislature is equipped to handle these under Chapter 107, and it's expressed its intention to do so.
But why, if you've got a jury that's going to be there in a week or two or 3 or 4 months or whenever, why would you trade that for the legislature in the great by and by, which maybe you'll get there and maybe you won't? Looks like you just go to trial and take your chances, and if you win, you win. If you lose, you lose.
Because it is inherent in the nature of sovereignty to be immune from suit, and it is inherent in the separation of powers in this state for the legislature to address, to waive sovereign immunity, and it is not a judicial role for the courts to step in and craft and judicially abrogate sovereign immunity. The court has always understood it may not selectively abrogate sovereign immunity, where here the legislature has crafted a remedy for certain breach of contract claims. They have Chapter 107 to address all other breach of contract claims, and for the court to step in and say, well, despite this legislative action, we're going to create something new.
Aren't you, in fact, feeding back to us Federal Sign and I.T. Davy? Aren't you, in fact, feeding back to us Federal Sign, which says that this, no matter who enters into the contract on behalf of the state, that you can't be sued over a breach of contract in our court, and I.T. Davy that says even if you perform the contract, you can't be sued in our court unless you have permission of the legislature. And a settlement agreement is no different than people giving up various rights to enter into an agreement for a subsequent promise to pay or a subsequent promise to take some sort of action. And the question is, can the state be bound by that agreement? And we've said, without permission of the state, you can't. Isn't that what we said?
Yes, that is.
Sure.
Proceed. That is, we are in agreement with those decisions. The court should not vary from those. And the court has consistently recognized that where the legislature has been active in an area, that it would be judicially unwise for the court to step in.
Any other?
What is the source of the waiver of immunity for wrongful termination? Is it the statute just in the labor code?
Yes.
Against the state?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't know the exact provision.
When you come back up, if you could tell us.
Court is ready to hear argument from Ms. Clay.
May it please the court, Mr. Brad Houston will present argument for response.
Good morning. This court should embrace the waiver by conduct exception in this very narrow fact situation for at least two reasons. The first reason is it is a very narrow fact situation, a very narrow exception, and it does not abrogate the legislature's prerogative to waive immunity in all cases. Secondly,
let me just, as a practical matter, if you'd gotten a money judgment against the state, you'd gone to judgment in the underlying lawsuit, and then the state said, we're not going to pay you, you still would have to go to the legislature.
That is correct, Your Honor. And in fact, that point supports our position and our suggestion of the exception. Because one of the policy reasons that there is for sovereign immunity is that the state should not be bound by long-term contracts that have big financial implications. And the point that you made, Your Honor, is that regardless of if we get this waiver or not, if we do get it, we still got to go to the legislature, and the legislature can still exercise its discretion over these policy issues as to whether to fund the judgment
or not. Well, but this has already been paid, hasn't it?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Was this one of those cases where the particular political subdivision has a fund that they can pay out without legislative approval? In other words, was this within an amount that they have the discretion to decide to settle and pay, and all they have to do is get the check from the comptroller?
I believe that that is correct. I believe that
so we don't have the public policy that you're asserting. Necessity to secure an appropriation from the legislature, which guides, or at least is part of, these kind of arguments. Is that correct in this case?
In this case, it is, Your Honor, for the reasons that you brought up. Number one, I believe that the funding of the underlying settlement was partially from the state and partially from Texas A&M, as I understand it. I was not the attorney involved in that action, but that's my understanding. The second issue or point with regard to that issue is that this was an obligation by the state that had no monetary parts. I mean, there was no cost to the state to perform. All they had to do was respond in a certain way to any official inquiry into.
By lie.
Pardon me?
By lie.
Well, let me address that, Your Honor. First of all, that goes to this voidness argument that the state is making. That argument fails for at least three reasons. First of all, the petition, the allegations in the petition pertaining to jurisdiction state that there were two obligations, affirmative obligations, with regard to communications with prospective employers, and also that they were to only give that information. The allegation in the petition as to the breach says, it doesn't say, you know, you didn't say the title correctly. What it says is they failed to give the information as required. That could have been any one of the three things. So even if, for the sake of argument, that this was a void provision, there are still two other obligations that have been properly pled as to the breach. Now,
we've read through all the briefs. Is there some other claim than that? I thought that was the only claim.
Well, the only claim is, Your Honor, I think what the confusion here is that the state is arguing and focusing on this one of three parts of the information.
What else is it, though?
Well, they had to give, there's actually three parts. One is the title, and that's this voidness argument. The second is the salary and the benefits. And the third is, and it states in the petition, that they were to only give that information. The breach alleged in the petition, and assuming that the court is going to review the petition in favor of jurisdiction, which is the law in the state, that if they gave more than what is required, that would also be a breach. And that is the way that that petition alleges the breach, that they didn't give the information as required, not specifically and only that they gave the wrong title. And the evidence in this case will show that not only did they say, oh, he was only an instructor, but they also said, if I say anything else, I could lose my job. Can you imagine a prospective employer hearing that about an employee that has risen all the way up to the top of their consideration? Their number one candidate.
The agreement says the director of personnel shall state that he may not provide any other information.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But he can't add, or I'd lose my
job. He can't add, you know, I wouldn't hire him in a million years.
No, he can't add, or I would lose my job.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because that goes beyond the specific terms of the mediation agreement.
Well, if the other person says, well, why can't you, what's he supposed to say?
I would submit to you, Your Honor, that the whole purpose of this mediation agreement was to pay this money and to give not only a neutral job reference overall, but to give a favorable one. If you'll look in the other parts...
Well, it's very favorable because it gives him a position he never had.
Well, let me address that, Your Honor. The state's argument is that that's void. This settlement agreement occurred in 1995. Dr. Lawson obtained his doctorate. He applied for a job in Kansas. He rose to the top of all the candidates. He was told he had the job. They just had to check a few things. And then he got a letter saying, sorry, we filled the position with another candidate. As you can well imagine, he was devastated. And that's when he started doing his investigation to find out why. He wrote a demand letter on his own to Texas A&M stating, we've got an agreement. You promised in writing to give the specific information, and you did not. He got a letter back from the Texas A&M system saying, you know what? We reviewed all this, and you're absolutely right. We messed up. We gave the wrong information. We're sorry. There's nothing we can do about it. You know, we can't give you your job back. There's nothing to do, but we're sorry. Well, it wasn't until after the lawsuit was filed and after the Attorney General's office got involved that somebody came up and said, hey, here's an angle. We'll say that it was void. And the reason why it's preposterous that it's void, Your Honor, is because, first of all, the president of the university was at this settlement, at this mediation. Provost of the university was at this mediation. Certainly those two positions had the authority, as alleged in the petition, to effectively promote Dr. Lawson.
Let's get back into the sovereign immunity argument.
Okay.
Why is that kind of contract where you're agreeing on something, not just money damages, but you're agreeing, obligating the state to take certain actions or to do something affirmatively in the future? How is that different from a regular contract? And aren't the policy considerations the same? Don't we want to... individual state actors at lower levels from binding the state to something that the state does not want to be bound to? Not this case, but let's suppose there were a collusive settlement agreement between a state agency and someone that put onerous obligations on the school system or the prison system or some other state entity, and the Attorney General comes in and says, wait a minute, I disavow the settlement agreement, and furthermore, you don't have, if you're going to sue on it, you've got to get permission from the legislature. So why should we treat those settlement agreements any differently than other contracts?
Because, Your Honor, under the exception that we're proposing, there is an out for the state. What we're proposing is that the private citizen or company has fully performed, and the state has accepted those benefits. If you get into a long-term contract with financial implications, as you suggested...
You claim discrimination. You fully perform. And the state enters into an agreed judgment with you and says, okay, we we had agreed to take all these measures, these curative measures, as part of the settlement agreement in the future. You say, oh, I fully perform, but yet the state has all these continuing obligations. And the Attorney General comes in and says, wait a minute. You know, you didn't run this by us, and you're not, I assert sovereign immunity. If you're going to force this contract, you've got to get permission to sue from the legislature.
Well, I submit, Your Honor, that if the state enters into a settlement agreement, they are not likely to commit the state to obligations that aren't justified. And that kind of goes to this obligation of the title, but addressing your point directly.
But it goes beyond that. Here in this suit and in your petition, I think you're requesting actual damages in your prayer, and you're requesting attorney's fees. So we're not just talking about a title. You all are now seeking money from the state, aren't you?
We are, Your Honor. And that is an excellent point, because the state should not be allowed, as this court has addressed earlier in these arguments, the state should not be allowed to be the subject of a dispute or a lawsuit that is within the proper jurisdiction of the court, and then, okay, we'll enter into a settlement agreement, and then we won't perform, and there will be nothing they can do about it except go to the legislature. And basically the reason why that cannot stand is the state should not be able to use alternative dispute resolution as an improper shield to eliminate jurisdiction when it once existed.
Well, you don't have to. I mean, it's like any other contract that for a performance of a contract under ITDATA, you don't have to deliver the equipment. You don't have to partially perform and give it to them like this. You don't have to give up your lawsuit. You can continue with the lawsuit. You don't have to settle. But having agreed to give up a valuable property interest in exchange for their promise to pay, you should know that they're not liable for, they're not, can't be sued without the legislative permission. I mean, that's no different than giving up valuable personal property
well,
to them.
That is a good point, Your Honor. And this court should not stand by and let the fallout of that principle occur. Because, it allows the state to improperly use sovereign immunity and to eliminate jurisdiction where it previously existed. It also allows...
But that argument means just because there's a direct relationship between the termination lawsuit and the settlement agreement that they should be treated the same vis-a-vis sovereign immunity. Is that right?
Well, there is the continuing jurisdiction argument that was made by the trial court.
Well, that hardly is going to work when it was a dismissal with prejudice.
Absolutely.
4 years later.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that's why it's incumbent on this court to adopt this waiver by exception or waiver by conduct exception because...
So you would agree that the current law doesn't provide for that theory of waiver of sovereign immunity.
I agree. I would concede that.
For to do so, this court would be extending the sovereign immunity theories vis-a-vis contracts to something that's never been done before, except by the Austin Court of Appeals.
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor. And we submit to the court that that should be done after weighing all the policy, weighing all the policy interests.
But for, as the state says, for over 100-plus years, this court, for whatever reasons, has left the policy decision vis-a-vis sovereign immunity to the legislature. And we have not taken on that choice. Why should we change that policy?
2 points, Your Honor. First of all, I disagree with the state's position that sovereign immunity is inherent and the court didn't have to create it. It may be inherent in the sovereign.
Well, let's say its genesis is somewhat murky. We all know they say, well, the king can do no wrong, therefore you can't ever sue him. Well, we're not really talking about that kind of sovereign immunity. We're talking about we know the state can do some wrong, but we're still going to have sovereign immunity to be sued. You have to go to the legislature to do it. And wherever it started, it's part of the common law that was adopted by the Constitution. Since that time, we have said that's a legislative prerogative.
Well, it's also important to note that this court created sovereign immunity in the state 154 years ago.
But that may
this
be
court,
so. But tell me a real reason why we should now say we think we're wrong for 150 years and we want to take it back and we're going to change it in this suit because it's a breach of a settlement agreement, what's brought about by a mediation process. In this one suit, why should we do that?
Your Honor, because the court is not wrong. It is our position that the state and is entitled to sovereign immunity until the legislature abolishes it. Now, notwithstanding the fact that Texas is in the minority, there's only three states that haven't either waived immunity in the contract context or eliminated immunity in the contract context. We're a minority state.
By whose stroke was that eliminated?
There are 21 states that waived immunity by the courts, and I believe there are 26 that have done it by the legislature. It is our position that in this narrow situation, this court cannot stand back after weighing the policy considerations and allow this injustice to occur. The policy reasons for supporting sovereign immunity in this case don't exist. But the policy reasons in favor of adopting the waiver by conduct exception do exist.
As was pointed out by Justice Rodriguez, there is a monetary impact of this current litigation based on the breach of the settlement agreement.
And that will be addressed by the legislature. If my client ever gets his day in court and if he gets a judgment, he will then...
But in order to get his day in court, he has to leapfrog Chapter 107 under the status of this particular agreement.
That's the state's position, and it is our position that the court should not allow the state to use alternative dispute resolution in an improper way.
So you're clearly saying we want this court to change the law and extend sovereign immunity as a public policy matter by this court to this case.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Based on waiver by conduct.
That is our position. After weighing the policy reasons.
Is there anything in the record about as to whether or not Mr. Lawson has tried to go to the legislature?
Not in the record, Your Honor, but I could address that as background and tell the court for background that was the worst experience in his life. He could not believe that he got the door slammed in his face so many times. In fact, in the record, in the federal sign case, it shows that for an 8-year period, only 6% of the cases where resolutions were presented to the legislature, did they even allow them to go forward. And that doesn't take into account the cases where, like my client, they didn't have any political power to get a legislator to listen to them. They didn't have any lobbyists. And that brings up a good point, and that is the reason, one of the main reasons why this court should not stand by when the legislature has failed to act. The legislature should have acted in this situation. And in 2260, they could have said, this is the administrative scheme, in any cases before, waiver by conduct will not
the problem under the current state of the law is that a claimant against the state can't even get a determination on the merits of the claim without the legislative permission. So there's no way to know if the claimant has a good case or a bad case or no case because there's never been any opportunity to make a claim if the state asserts sovereign immunity at the door. Isn't that right?
I'm not sure I followed that question, Your Honor.
The problem is on this settlement agreement, there will never be a determination of whether or not there was a valid settlement agreement or an invalid settlement agreement or any consideration for the settlement agreement, and nothing on the merits of this if the legislature doesn't even open the door to the courthouse on this claim.
If the legislature or the court doesn't. That's correct. I would agree. Finally, my client would ask the court to weigh these policy considerations. And this number one policy consideration in favor of sovereign immunity about the long-term financial aspects are not there. Of course, if he wins his day in court, there will be, as the court properly pointed out. But he should at least get his day in court. He should not be denied the jurisdiction that he had before merely because he participated in alternative dispute resolution, which is a express public policy of this state. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel, I wanted to figure out just what happens to state employees, because as I understand 2260, 2260 only applies to contractors. So by definition, it's excluding the employees of the state. So 2260 is not applying now, and if immunity has already been waived now in discrimination or wrongful discharge suits by the employees of this state, take it from there for me. If the state enters into a settlement agreement in one of these employee lawsuits to recover on the settlement agreement if the state refuses to pay, each and every state employee will now need to go to the legislature for redress?
Your Honor, even if sovereign immunity had been waived in the underlying suit, that cannot resurrect jurisdiction for this lawsuit that was filed 4 years after the previous lawsuit had been dismissed. The court in Mantis versus Fifth Court.
I'm not going on the continuing jurisdiction either, so you can disregard that.
Okay. Well, a party would have to go to the legislature. It does not fall under 2260's administrative procedures, but the legislature has essentially occupied the field here. They've said, here are certain contracts that fall under 2260. Other contracts do not fall under that, but 107 still applies. Parties have to go to the legislature to get consent under 107. And this is a remedy for parties. They can go to the legislature and get that addressed. Here the legislature has acted. This is not like the situation faced by the court in Texas Department of Criminal Justice versus Miller in the Tort Claims Act context, where despite repeated judicial pleas.
Ms. Parente, if I'm involved in litigation with the state, in litigation in which the state has waived immunity from suit, are you saying that now people should, if they settle their case with the state, they should not dismiss their lawsuit? They should leave it pending until they make sure that the state has fully performed under the agreement. Because otherwise, they could dismiss that lawsuit, which they were entitled to bring and entitled to litigate under the state, and it will go away, dependent then upon whether or not the legislature, at its pleasure, decides to move forward. So should this opinion read that people should act with care and not dismiss their lawsuit until the state fully performs the agreement?
No, Your Honor. There's been no indication that the state is breaching settlement agreements routinely.
But we have to be concerned about the consequences. And I understand that you keep saying, well, we don't do it very often, so it's not a problem. But the consequence of this would be if I am litigating against the state in a suit in which immunity from suit has been waived by the state, I think that I would have to be careful and not dismiss my lawsuit until I made sure the state fully performed and I got everything I wanted. Is that what the state would like to see happen in settlement agreements?
No, Your Honor. In most cases, a case is going to be agreed and dismissed.
It wouldn't be prudent on my part to dismiss my lawsuit then until I knew that you had fully performed. What advice would you give me if you were my lawyer?
In most cases, the primary benefit is going to be a monetary payment, and suit can...
No, we're all asking about this case. What could Mr. Lawson have done? First, he could go all the way through the trial. Not go to ADR, but if he does and gets a judgment that includes a mandatory injunction, how would he ever enforce it? Because the judge is not going to leave a case on file forever.
That's right. And in Mantis versus Fifth Court of Appeals, the court held that breaches of settlement agreements should be suits for breach of settlement agreements should be treated like any other breach of contract case.
What if this
case,
had been a breach of judgment, though? What if the parties had gone to mediation and the court had entered this not as a settlement agreement? The court said, okay, I'm going to embody all of these terms in a breach of judgment, and the state was directed to do exactly what the settlement agreement said. And how would that be enforceable against the state? A judgment out of the court embodying these terms?
There is some federal case law that would indicate that if the final judgment incorporated the terms of the settlement agreement, and we cited it in our brief, that may be enough, at least a federal court, to have jurisdiction to bring suit. But there's no Texas authority on that. But the Texas courts have made clear you parties need a clear and unambiguous legislative waiver to bring suit, and
was
they have
this,
to plead that as part of show that the court has jurisdiction. They have to show that the court that there has been legislative consent.
Was this settlement agreement reached by people who were authorized by the state to do this settlement agreement and pay this amount of money?
There's no question that the state officials were authorized to enter into the agreement, but they
and
were
also,
not.
And they could also authorize the amount of money that was paid. So they could they were operating within the parameters set out under state law or their authorization to be able to settle lawsuits.
Yes.
And does the state have similar types of authority in place with respect to litigation, other types of litigation, so that there are people who know what their parameters are and what they can do, and the state says, yes, it's okay for you to settle on these terms, but if you get outside these terms, more money or something else, and you have to have additional authority. So the state has a system in place to protect itself from unauthorized settlement agreements.
Yes, but there's no...
Is that right? Is that correct?
The state officials are authorized, certain state officials are authorized to enter into these agreements, but what can happen and what has happened in cases, what happens in cases like this is that officials may improvidently agree to certain settlement agreements and the state is best bound.
Improvidently, making a bad decision is an entirely different issue than making a decision without authority. You can have authority and not exercise it wisely, and that's a different matter. My question is, does the state have in place a system in which it has made policy decisions about who should have the authority and the extent of that authority to settle lawsuits on behalf of the state?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Okay.
You're going to answer my question about the source.
I don't have a site for you, and I could look for one and submit it, but regardless...
Because your whole argument here is premised on that the waiver is by express legislative consent.
Yes, Your Honor.
So regardless of
whether the underlying suit had waived, whether sovereign immunity had been waived for that, that is a separate lawsuit.
I understand, but I'm interested in what the source of the waiver is for wrongful termination.
I can try to provide that to the court in this submission letter brief.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the arguments in today's causes, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
All right. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.